First of all, I'd like to thank Philippe for having invited me to Cambridge to take part in this event. Having taught at a university which in the Shanghai ranking is in the fifth, let's say between 50 and 60, coming to a place like Cambridge, of course, is always a cause for awe and respect. And I hope you see that I'm serious about that. Another reason why I followed his invitation with great pleasure was that here I find myself among friends, professional friends, but also personal friends. Philippe encouraged me actually to start with a few words about Galicia. Now my guess is that contemporary Englishmen, when they hear Galicia, they think that might be a nice place to retire in northern Spain, good fish, and pilgrimage place Compostela in the neighborhood for the Catholics among you. Well, the Galicia that I was fascinated with was the Galicia that we have been talking about and in which our story starts and takes place. And my fascination dates back to my very first semester studying law in Innsbruck, actually, in Austria. I'm also Austrian. When I learned that the Allgemeines Bürgerliches Gesetzbuch, which is the civil code of Austria, which is really recognized as one of the leading, very enlightened, codes of civil law, had actually been tried out in Galicia. So in 1797, the Austrians enacted the Galician civil code and put it into force in this part of their, most eastern part of their empire at the time, and it was recognized as the predecessor of the ABGB, which was put into force in Austria in 1811. So it was officially, this Galician civil code was enacted to fill gaps that had arisen because of the change in territorial sovereignty with Poland and Russia and Austria being involved. But I think it was also a testing ground for a civil code, and that gets me maybe, and that made me think of another thing which I learned in my very first year at Innsbruck, namely the origin and genesis of jus gentium, which has something to do with our international law, with the Romans, alert lawyers as they were, just setting up a special officer, the praetor for the foreigners, and then developing rules that were more modern and not as rigid. And that reminded me of Galicia, so a strange combination between Rome and Galicia. But here I am. So those were my thoughts at the beginning of my law studies. And the fascination has continued. One of my favorite writers is Joseph Roth, not Philip, Joseph Roth, who was born in, Philip Roth. I mean, of course, Philip Sands is one of my favorite writers, of course. But the Joseph Roth was born in Brody, which is apparently very close to Lemberg. And actually, he went to the same university that we have heard about yesterday, namely to the University of Lemberg. He entered the university in 1913, but contrary to the others, went to Vienna a year later. But he returned to Galicia and Lemberg as an Austrian soldier later during World War I. And if you want to read one book which captures the atmosphere of, on the one hand, this kind of decaying empire, no pun intended any, I mean, I'm a guest here and I'm okay. But this atmosphere of decaying empire, on the other hand, this mixture of cultures, then I advise you to read Radetzky March, the book published in 1932 by Joseph Roth. And if that's too long a book, it has about 300 pages, I advise you to read my absolute favorite, which is The False Wait, which describes the fate of an Austrian civil servant in Galicia, in the late 19th century. And of course, some of you might rather have heard of Bruno Schulz and his Zimtläden. So these people are really my favorites and explain a bit why this foreign place has some interest to me. There was also a little anecdote, but because one of my protectors and mentors in Austria was Alfred Ferdross. Maybe you've heard the name, some of you. And Ferdross apparently liked me very much, and he said, "Bruno, if we still had the monarchy, we would make you a professor in Czernowitz, and then we would call you back to Vienna." Now, I have to say, Czernowitz is not in Galicia. Czernowitz is in Bukovina, but the Bukovina was incorporated legally into Galicia in the mid-19th century. So even I have a very, let's say, fragile relationship with that region of the world. But also legally, returning to the law, this Austro-Hungarian monarchy has a fascination, I think, which I share with Philip. You know, just imagine in the Austro-Hungarian parliament before World War I, you had 16 different nationalities conversing, or rather fighting, slugging it out in 9 different languages. The so-called prison of nations. I think it wasn't just a prison, but of course it was decaying, and you probably have made the same experience a few decades ago. But when you read Hans Kelsen, I think both in the theory of law of Hans Kelsen and also in the work of Ferdross, you see, I think there is an imprint of that vision that there can be a community under the law, because that was more or less what kept this Austro-Hungarian Empire together. So I think in a way it made me think of the United Nations, an early forerunner. Of course, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, I don't want to kind of embellish it, it was rotten, but the UN is also rotten, or rotting, really. But this is interesting. Now let me turn to genocide. And like Philip, actually Philip Allott sitting over there, you must be proud, because almost every speaker, with the exception of Ms. Kennedy, has referred to you. You sit in the back, but you are one of the major players here. So I would also start with some references to Philip Allott. He told me yesterday over dinner that he doesn't like human rights at all. But in his early work, the earliest of this works that I have read, Eunomia, about 20 years ago, he said things about human rights which I think I would like to start with, but just quoting two pieces of this Eunomia from Philip Allott. He speaks about the fate of human rights in the contemporary international legal world, which of course he doesn't like either. Let me quote. So he says, "Human rights were appropriated by governments, swept up into the maw of an international bureaucracy, turned into bureaucratic small change, a plaything of governments and lawyers." And the second quote, "Governments have been reassured in their arrogance by the idea that if they are not proved actually to be violating the substance of particularized human rights, if they can bring their willing and acting within the words of this and that formula with its lawyerly qualifications and exceptions, then they are doing well enough." And I think that this quote, which I have been using very often, gets me to just say a few things on genocide and the appropriation of the term, of the concept of genocide, its bureaucratization, and maybe also arranging right up to the abuse of the term. And I'd like to start with an example from the war in Yugoslavia, namely the genocide case that came before my court and was decided in 2007. Now, the genocide case, a case which Bosnia-Herzegovina brought against Serbia as a state, and James has referred to it, so the state committing genocide, which was recognized by this court. But the factual findings of the ICJ were essentially based on a decision which the ICTY, the International Criminal Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia, had rendered not too long before we had our own judgment, the so-called Krstic case. Krstic, a high-ranking officer in the Republika Srpska army, which was condemned of having been an accomplice in the genocide at Srebrenica. And a lot of what the ICJ says about Srebrenica, the only instance in which both the ICTY and the ICJ found that genocide had had been committed. So what we say is based on what Krstic says, and there wasn't any additional fact-finding done on the basis of our court. So just referring to Krstic, and then what do we say about, what do we have to deal with? Well, genocide is about the destruction of a group. So the lawyers had to deal with the question, have the 7,000 men that were killed in Srebrenica, did they constitute a group? And Krstic says the Muslims of Srebrenica were part of a group, only part of a group, but this part was emblematic for the whole group and essential for the survival of the group, and therefore Krstic, ICTY, and later on the ICJ were able to find that genocide had been committed, because this was the group that had been annihilated was a group in the sense of the term of the Genocide Convention. And then both Krstic and we had to turn to the genocidal intent, that special intent, not just to kill, let's say, Irish people or Austrians because of their looks, but because you want to get rid of the entire group. Genocidal intent. And there the two courts went into something which I consider problematic. For instance, they said the genocidal intent of Mladic and Karadzic and their gang was only formed only after the takeover of Srebrenica, they say. So killings had been occurred on 12 and 13 July 1995 in a place near Srebrenica with the name of Potokari. And the courts distinguished and said, well, the killings in Potokari were not genocide because this intent had not been filled. But from 13 July onwards, the killing of people around Srebrenica that went on for days, this was done with genocidal intent. Another question was, but I mean, any annihilation, destruction of a group. I mean, you have only killed 1/5 of the Muslim population of Srebrenica. Is that enough? And the courts say, yeah, it was only 1/5 of the population, but the community said this destruction, these killings, inevitably resulted in the physical disappearance of the Muslim population of Srebrenica. And if you look into the files of the Krstic case, you find arguments about, all right, 7,000 men killed. The women and the children were forcibly, let's say, driven out of the country. Did they have a chance to find men? Did they have a chance to, let's say, promulgate families again? Now, maybe all of this is what criminal lawyers think and don't really consider to be extraordinary. Maybe it's just lawyering, but I mean, would the prosecution and punishment of that crime at Srebrenica as a crime against humanity not have been sufficient, or I'm very careful with my words, but dignified in a sense, instead of going into, yeah, only 1/5, only the men, how about the women, would they find partners again? I have to say that has disturbed me. Of course, the ICJ, my court, did not have an opportunity, would not have been able to say that it wasn't genocide, it was a crime against humanity, because the only jurisdictional basis we had was the Genocide Convention. And so, of course, the claimant, Bosnia-Herzegovina, squeezed everything that happened to that needle's eye of the Genocide Convention, which presupposes genocide. So that was behind that, let's say, well, okay, these problems. Philip has spoken yesterday about the hierarchy of crimes, right? You find somebody guilty of genocide, and thereby automatically you kind of, lower the evil of normal crimes against humanity. A bit like, war crimes as severe violations of international humanitarian law versus just, well, okay, and then you have a problem finding the adjective. What is it? Normal violations of IGL? Just not so terribly bad violations. So that I think is a real problem. Now, of course, putting myself into the shoes of Lenkin, for him it was a look back in anger. I mean, this immediacy, 1945, 1946, 1947. But I think it is a concept which I find replete with questions and problems for the future. And I'd like just to give a few, let's say, points of evidence which might be anecdotal, but we would really need to have more time. First of all, there is a divergence of definitions. When I was a professor at Innsbruck, I had to speak time and again before groups of Armenians. For the Armenians, the question wasn't whether what had happened to their group in 1914, 15, 16 was genocide. For them, what mattered was could that crime still be prosecuted before the International Court of Justice? And I remember I had an Austrian colleague, Felix Ermakora, actually a great human rights lawyer, always gave the first speech and said, this was genocide and it's a crime and there has to be, and there are possibilities. And then came Bruno Zimmer, who said, actually, there is no way to get that vindicated. You won't get compensation under the law at the time. I'm talking about the 1970s, the 1980s. Or the 10 million Germans that were driven out of, let's say, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and other countries after World War II, they claimed that what had happened, that ethnic cleansing had been an act of genocide. And as you might know, the ICJ both and the ICTY concluded that ethnic cleansing, the driving of entire populations off their, let's say, their Heimat, their home, did not constitute genocide if the intention behind was simply to get rid of the Germans and make the country, let's say, free for other Czechs and for other Poles, maybe the Poles that were driven from Eastern Poland into West by Russia kind of extending her borders. So the divergence of definitions. The narrowest, of course, strict definition of the Genocide Convention. But even national legislations not really keeping to that definition. I remember when, in the Pinochet case, I remember having read that the Spanish criminal code, Spain asking for extradition of Pinochet from the UK, that extradition was, among other things, based on genocide. And the definition of genocide in the Spanish Civil Code, at least at the time, was more or less a definition of crimes against humanity. So you have national codes kind of extending the definition. And of course, the extensions become numerous and almost everywhere in the literature. I remember a colleague of mine at the University of Michigan, Catherine McKinnon, one of the leading feminist lawyers, coined the phrase genocide, because what she was focusing on were the crimes and the rape committed during the war in Yugoslavia. The impatience of the NGOs with the legal concept of genocide. Other things are also genocide, aren't they? And the lawyer, well, you know, we have a definition, Roman 1, Roman 2, etc., in the convention. Then this phenomenon of beware of genocide. I remember in 1994, I happened to be working at the UN in Geneva when the genocide in Rwanda had taken place, and it became known what had happened. And I remember that the American diplomats were walking around and asking us, would you please be so kind and not call that genocide? Could you call it genocidal acts, but not genocide, just like that? Because they were afraid that, of course, if the community would agree this was genocide, everybody would look at the U.S. and say, do something. And they didn't want to do anything. Or political manipulation. Well, Philip, I'm not at the ICJ anymore, but I think the case that Croatia still has before the ICJ against Serbia, claiming that what happened in the Vukovar in the early phase of the war in Yugoslavia, Vukovar, you know, hundreds of people killed in hospitals, etc., that committed genocide, apparently. So my prognosis is now it's never going to be recognized as genocide. But, you know, what a great chance for a regime to accuse another regime of genocide. And, of course, you don't give that up easily. or and the last thing I'm going to mention, I just came across a few weeks ago in the New York Times International Weekly. It's a report on a trial that is will be taking place in Romania, and there the Romania has the only people that were punished for the crimes of the Ceausescu regime in Romania were Mr. Ceausescu and his wife. But now it looks they're going to prosecute one person. The name of that person is Mr. Vizinescu. Mr. Vizinescu was a torturer, and he was in charge of one of the, let's say, prisons for political criminals. Terrible, terrible, terrible. And what do you read in this paper? They say, so the, even the Dan Voinea, a Roman criminology professor, said Romania's political and economic elites are still dominated by former communists, their relatives and allies, quote, who want to make sure that the crimes of communism are never unveiled and never prosecuted in a serious way. And another expert says, Mr. Stefan doubts that the authorities are really serious about putting Mr. Vizinescu in jail. Fueling those doubts is the fact that Mr. Vizinescu has been charged with genocide, which will be difficult to make stand up in a Roman court, a Romanian court, not Roman, sorry. And then, quote, they have charged him with genocide just so they can close this file without a result. So a regime, let's say the remnants of the old regime, tried to get a scapegoat. Punish that person, accuse him of something which they know is never going to stand up. Actually, a bit like the earlier jurisprudence of the ICTY, when the prosecutors charged criminals with genocide and fell on their nose time and again. Okay, let's see what happens with Karadzic and Mladic. So I conclude, what is the added value of qualifying a crime of against humanity further, as we do with the crime of genocide? Of course, Lemkin's, let's say, vision or, let's say, view of genocide captured precisely the characteristics of the Holocaust. But I just wonder whether what we have here is not what other international criminal Maginot line, you know, the Maginot line, fortresses which the French built after World War I to prevent another, let's say, German, let's say, progress in World War I. It happened because in World War II, it wasn't really any obstacle to the German troops in 1940. So do we have an international criminal Maginot line, a look back in anger, something built up, but which simply turns out not to serve its purpose? Now, that might have been sounded rather negative, but my last line is that I really have not made up my mind yet whether it is worth, let's say, supporting the notion or not. I just have to read more and think more and listen more to people like Philip. Thank you very much.